Gold tends to do well in years where there's a lot happening on the elections front based on our historical performance analysis.
Welcome to another episode of Unearthed, the podcast where we'll unearth all you need to know about gold and the role it plays in today's societies and markets. My name is Joe Cavatoni, Senior Market Strategist at the World Gold Council. I'm here with my colleague and co-host, John Reed.
Our focus for this episode is on the macroeconomic environment and specifically the impact of a hard or soft landing on investment assets, including gold.
And our guest today, we're excited to have, is Karim Chadid, head of EMEA Investment Strategy for iShares and a managing director at BlackRock. Karim, it's great to have you here with us on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great, Karim. So let's jump straight into some questions. How would you describe the current macroeconomic environment? What key factors are influencing it? And how do you perceive the overall economic climate at present?
It's a great place to start because I think the macroeconomic environment today is one that is difficult to analyze in a cyclical framework. You know, when we think about the business cycle and where we could be, whether it's early cycle, late cycle, whether we're in recession and expansion, all those types of frameworks kind of go out the window in the current environment, given that we have just come out of a pretty protracted period of low growth and are still very much in a stagnation environment where we're just starting to catch up with the growth trend. And I'm talking about the US economy here. But we never really saw, despite the many expectations of a recession, we didn't really see an outright recession play out. And I think the best characteristic is not that of a soft landing or a hard landing in this environment. Rather, it's coming out of the pandemic shock and coming back to some sort of a trend normal for growth. And this will be a key theme this year as we see this inflationary trend play out. So as we see inflation continue to fall, thanks to the goods prices unwind, while simultaneously see growth continue to catch up to trends.
Are you actually looking then for a reacceleration of growth? I mean, I get the slowdown in inflation. That's pretty obvious around the world and in the US in particular. But I think most people are expecting growth to slow. Are you rather saying that we're going to see growth stabilize and even accelerate?
I think it depends on the region. When looking at the global economy, our prediction is that growth will remain low, not necessarily slow down further from here, not necessarily see a recession. That's not our base case, but rather that growth will remain fairly low, below trends. And in Europe, however, and this is where the regional difference comes in, we pretty much all but saw a recession last year. Now, the official numbers that came out in January don't confirm a recession because we escaped a recession in Europe by just a very small amount. But we pretty much did see that complete halt in the economy last year. And so in Europe, we might see an early cycle trend this year where we start to pick up from the lows. All our analysis of activity data and also business sentiment data suggests that a trough in Europe may be behind us in Q4. And so that's where the regional differentiation comes in.
Fantastic. That's really useful. Now, I believe that you at BlackRock and your team have identified a number of key themes, so-called mega forces, that you believe will influence portfolios and investors this year. Can you give us a bit more detail on each of those themes?
Sure. So as you rightly point out, we introduced a framework that helps us think of asset allocation drivers that go beyond just the macro environment that we just discussed, go beyond that climate that we just talked about. These are asset allocation drivers that will continue to play a key factor in asset allocation over the long term. In other words, someone might call them secular trends. We identified actually five of them. The first is the transition to the net zero economy. The second is artificial intelligence. The third is geopolitical fragmentation. The fourth is really focused around the future of finance. And the fifth is on aging demographics. And each of these mega forces have an impact on growth have an impact on inflation and thus have an impact on one's estimate of the neutral rate, the long-term interest rate, and also have an impact on asset allocation. The reality is that the jury is still out in terms of the impact on a lot of these forces because they're still playing out in live terms and there are areas of ongoing research. For example, AI, artificial intelligence is all else equal boosting productivity, which should all else equal be deflationary and good for growth. But to what extent is still unclear. It's still an area of ongoing research. And then those impacts from AI, do they more than offset the inflationary impact that you get from things like aging demographics, given the tightness of labor supply that this causes, as we saw in the US with the retirement of a lot of workers that led to a lot of inflation, and in our view will continue to lead to inflation. In fact, we expect a re-acceleration of inflation in the US when we enter 2025 after the disinflation of this year because of this trend of aging demographics that had led to labor supply tightness.
So, picking up on a couple of those points then, when do you think AI is actually going to start to really contribute to changing economic growth? In other words, this increase in productivity that a lot of people are calling for, is that something that we might see this year or is that something that we're going to have to wait a bit longer, would you say?
So from the perspective of an investor, I think it is within the investable time horizon. So it does matter to stock markets. It mattered to stock markets in 2023. And in our view, it will matter to stock markets in 2024. But in terms of the tangible economic impact, this is a multi-year story. It's not, you know, something that will be done in 6 months. But in terms of how it matters to stock markets, it matters for market sentiment and for earnings of companies.
Yeah, whereas obviously the aging demographic is something that we're living with right now, and it's something that was seen in the recovery from COVID with the dramatic shortage of labor that was seen in the US and in other markets too.
Exactly.
So turning to some of the other mega forces that you've identified, geopolitical fragmentation and economic competition was one of the ones. What does that mean and what are the implications for investors? How should they think about this topic?
So I think this means all else equal, more inflation. I say all else equal because obviously in a world of moving parts in the economy, you kind of have to isolate for a certain factor to see what the impact is. And I say more inflation because the rewiring of supply chains that is happening in real time is causing an increase in input costs and trade costs. We've already seen this start developing, for example, in the context of Mexico and its trading relationship with the US, which has increased drastically over the past few years, and it has become a leading trading partner with the US. And so this is a good segue to answer your question, how should investors think about this? I think in an emerging market equity environment, it also creates dispersion in emerging markets, and there are single country stock markets that should be well positioned in this environment. So I mentioned Mexico as a beneficiary of this restructuring and supply chains, but also you could think of India in this light. And the other aspect, which is a good segue to gold, is one of the symptoms of this geopolitical environment is that we've been seeing gold reserves increase in central banks across the world. And this has become a bigger driver. I analyze ETF flows regularly. And for example, 2023 was a good example of a year where the central bank purchases of gold were a bigger driver of gold returns. Gold was up 13% in 2023, despite the backup in real rates. Bigger driver of gold returns than the money in motion that we see in flows, because flows were actually quite poor. So that's interesting to think about going forward.
No, absolutely. That's something we've been highlighting in our research regularly as well, as I'm sure listeners will have picked up. On another one of your mega forces, I see energy and materials as something that you think is worthy of consideration. Do you want to talk through what you've identified in this area?
Thinking about the transition to net zero, transition is a really important mega force in the context of the investment opportunity that it provides in areas where you need the materials that are required for that transition economy. So thinking about battery metals, for instance, like lithium, cobalt, thinking about copper. These are all metals that are needed in the transition. And we're seeing a greater proliferation of demand for these exposures, as well as vehicles to access them in the form of products, whether ETFs or otherwise, in order to access them. And I think looking at this megaforce as an opportunity, as an investment opportunity in and of itself.
And certainly we've seen this come up in the discussions from various governments about critical minerals as well, and defining certain elements as vital to the energy transition or indeed to defense. There must be a way for investors to take exposure to these critical minerals, would you say?
Exactly. And that's my point about the proliferation of more and more investment vehicles to access them.
As we listen to you describe your mega forces, it's really very obvious that they're all interlinked, more so than you want to naturally start to kind of look at them and understand. I think if you think about what John has just raised in terms of critical minerals and the differences for the major economies around the globe, for the US versus the EU versus Australia, Canada, different versions of these critical minerals list, what matters to these different countries, what matters to these different economies in terms of the future, and how that can be impacted by geopolitical risks and that fragmentation that develops. It's all very interesting. And I would love to hear some further thinking on the geopolitical landscape that you might want to share with us. And just in terms of how you try to assess it as a risk or an opportunity, it sounds like this is more of an opportunity that you're identifying. Maybe you give us a few ideas of where you think investors are kind of honing in for opportunities there.
Yeah. And I like the word that you're using around the opportunity, because I think with a lot of the mega forces that we're talking about, there's an investment opportunity to look at the theme within the fragmentation piece. You know, I already mentioned Mexico. I mentioned India. I also think here, you can think about it in the context of, in private markets, focus on more warehouses. In public equities, a focus on more industrials as a sector that could benefit from an environment where supply chains are more localized. This is not deglobalization. This is not saying that the world is not going to trade with each other anymore. Of course, it's going to continue to trade with each other and trade even more. But the way that it's going to trade with each other is changing. And that throws up opportunities in those areas that I'm mentioning.
Karim, you've done a lot to talk to geopolitical fragmentation, and 2024 puts in front of us a year with a significant number of elections. Maybe you could share some insight on how you're thinking about that and what that could lead for 2024 in terms of the outlook.
So I think this year is an interesting year from a geopolitical calendar because it is the largest number of voters, certainly in my career that I've seen. So a huge part of the population of the world is going to the polls. You have the European parliamentary election in the spring. You have India's voting, Mexico, Taiwan already voted. You also have elections in the UK, in the US. So there's a lot happening this year from a geopolitical calendar perspective. And I think in the context of the election calendar, historically, you would have seen that we did some analysis on the desk to see the performance of different asset classes in previous years of big elections. And you would see that in those years, traditional safe haven plays actually perform fairly differently. So, for example, it's not necessary that the dollar is strong in a year where there's a lot of elections. It really depends on other factors happening. So there are other factors that explain the performance of the dollar in that context, whether it's the, you know, central bank policy, the state of global liquidity tightening or loosening, the strength of the economy, et cetera, et cetera. Gold tends to do well in years where there's a lot happening on the elections front based on our historical performance analysis. I do think there's an element of looking at flows and positioning, and our analysis suggests, as I was alluding to earlier with my comment about gold flows being quite poor in 2023, even as gold performed, and even as the correlation between gold and real rates broke down in 2023, it's rare that it performed double digits when real rates were backing up so strongly. So when I think about 2024 and the election calendar and our historical performance analysis on gold, combined with the positioning, and the positioning is light because the flows were lackluster, I think it's an area that is likely to be in demand this year. So from a multi-asset lens, we're looking at gold as a diversification this year because of the many elections.
Of course, there are other assets as well. And I see the last of the mega forces that you've identified is the future of finance. I suspect that doesn't involve gold directly and perhaps one of the more alternatives potentially.
With the future of finance, this is really a theme which keeps us focused on an asset class that has grown a lot over the past few years, which is private lending. So the role of private lending in our view is growing globally, especially in the US and Europe. And this doesn't mean that all private lending is created equal. It doesn't mean we like the entire asset class. Again, here, dispersion is a key theme. And we like to stay up in quality in the asset class because we are cognizant of our own view that the global economy is stagnant. We're not very upbeat on the global economic outlook. In Europe, we're just coming out of a recession, for instance. So we do keep an up in quality approach in this asset class, but we see this asset class as having grown a lot and has the opportunity to structurally grow a lot even further because of the landscape where regulation has meant that bank lending has become more limited in its growth. And also the high interest rate environment has meant that it has also curtailed bank lending. So private credit, private lending in specific is an area which has been rising, and we think it will continue to grow as an asset class. And that's what we talk about when we talk about future of finance.
Okay, that's really clear. Thank you. You've spoken a little bit about your expectation for the global economy, particularly the US economy. I was going to ask you about hard landing versus soft landing, but I think you've laid out pretty much that you're not really looking at either of those opportunities or scenarios to play out. So what do you expect from the Fed this year?
Yeah.
As you pointed out, interest rates are high, inflation's coming down. Obviously, you know, the Fed will have to move at some point. What are your expectations, and how does BlackRock think about these things?
So I'm calling this the year of disinflation and rate cuts. So whichever way you slice it and dice it, the rate cuts are coming this year. We can debate how many versus how much the market is pricing, but they are coming. We think the Fed would probably start cutting in June or around June. May, June is the area that we're looking at. The market pricing of that has shifted around, but is towards greater than 50% chance of this happening, so that it is priced by markets. But a key point is that markets are pricing a lot for the Fed. Markets are pricing almost 6 cuts for the Fed, which isn't unlike market pricing in the past. You know, markets are not incredibly accurate when it comes to Fed pricing. They rarely get it right. And in fact, we don't think they're getting it right this year either, because we don't think the Fed will cut 6 times. We do think they'll start in the mid-year, but we think they'll cut closer to 3 or maybe 4 if the inflation trend really continues to accelerate towards target this year. But we don't think they'll go all the way to 6. That sounds like a hard landing scenario, which, as I articulated earlier, we don't think is what's happening. And so why do we think the Fed won't go all the way to what the market is pricing? Primarily because of our view that inflation will re-accelerate at the turn of the year into 2025 due to the restriction on labor supply that we have had from the early retirement of a lot of workers in the US, which will cause wages to re-accelerate.
So if there's one particular data point that you'll be paying attention to, it's non-farm payrolls, it's the growth of the workforce, you'd say is perhaps being the most crucial thing that investors should be paying attention to at the moment as a indicator of when and how much the Fed will move.
Yeah, exactly. I think the labor market data is super important. And it's important to zoom out and look at it in the lens of not the cyclical framework. Because if you're looking at it from a cyclical framework, you'll think, wow, over the past 2 years, the growth we've had in the US labor market suggests that the economy is now overheating. And we disagree with that. We need to zoom out and look at it in the context of the reopening and the return to work. And when you look at it through that lens on a 3-5 year horizon, it just looks to be catching up to trend as opposed to an overheating scenario.
Gotcha.
really is interesting that you're kind of standing alone in terms of calling out the COVID scenario and the environment that's come as a consequence of it as something that will break the models, where the models don't fit the scenario of what we're dealing with. Quite a unique set of circumstances. And if you're thinking about that in terms of what it means for investors, I think your research is showing that cash allocations could reach as high as 8% on average.
Yeah.
And, you know, should investors be looking to put cash to work? I know that's been something BlackRock's talked to a lot, which is don't leave your cash idle, put it to work. Tell us how you think about that and what investors should be considering.
Let me unpack the 8% stat that you just shared. So we've done an analysis of wealth portfolios in EMEA. So that's Europe, Middle East, Africa, collating all the portfolios that we've analyzed and looking at the trend of how much cash allocations and portfolios have been moving over the past years. And what we found is that the cash sleeve in the average wealth portfolio in EMEA went from 3% in 2021 to 5% in 2022. And remember, 2021 was a positive year for risk, 2022 a bad one. So it went up to 5% in 2022. That's only a 2% increase. But then after the shock of 2022, double-digit drops in stocks and bonds, we get to 2023 and cash allocations go up to 8%. So they almost trebled in 2 years. And I think that is much to do with the high cash rate that these portfolios, these investors can get, mixed with the conservative asset allocation. And the implications of this are twofold. One is, how long will it take for these investors to put that cash back to work? Because positioning is not stretched. You know, even equity ownership is not stretched in the context of the double-digit rally in 2023 flows, where if you look at the aggregate industry flows across mutual funds and ETFs, flows were stagnant, which is unusual in a year where returns were double-digit. And that's much because of the cash allocations. So how quickly those cash allocations will be put to work is the first implication, because as they do get put to work, that can carry risk appetite forward and could create a good year for risk in 2024. So a good year to invest. And we actually recently upgraded US equities and are more positive on DM stocks, partly because of this. And then the second implication is, how much do rates need to come down, given that we have rate cuts coming, to attract these allocations out of cash? So a push and a pull situation. And on that second one, there's also somewhat of an urgency. On the first one, maybe it's not super urgent, but on the second one, there's somewhat of an urgency because in fixed income, you want to buy the bonds now before yields come down. And if rate cuts are starting mid-year, you kind of want to move sooner rather than later.
So in terms of the cash that was accumulated over those periods of time, did it come from any particular asset class? Do you think it was more from the bond portfolio or from the equity side of business? Or where did you think it was being accumulated from?
It's not easy to assess where it came from, but I think when you look at the aggregate fund flows, you do see a trend where equities were more likely owned. I think in 2022, the likelihood is that it came from both bonds and stocks, whereas in 2023, more from stocks, because actually bond flows were pretty strong.
Okay.
Is there room for alternative assets such as gold?
Of course. So I think when we look at the portfolio allocations, there's a sleeve for alternatives. So we look at private markets as a big part, of course, and a growing part for diversification. One key thing to bear in mind is that the correlation between stocks and bonds is no longer reliable, because you can have quite positively correlated periods between stocks and bonds. And whilst the opportunity in fixed income is super interesting because yields are higher, bonds for ballast have gotten challenged over the past couple of years because of this positive correlation between stocks and bonds. And so a greater sleeve to private markets is one implication. And then another implication is a greater sleeve in exposures like gold. Whilst they're non-yielding, they are diversifying from a returns perspective versus more highly correlated stocks and bonds.
That pretty much covers the topics we wanted to cover. Normally at this point in the podcast, Kareem, we actually ask our guests to share a fun fact about gold, whether it relates directly to them or to the market. I think maybe, John, I'll let you go first and share one, and maybe we can, Kareem, have you share an interesting fun fact about the market as well. But John, why don't you kick it off? Give us your fun fact on gold.
Thanks, Joe. And this is one that I was asked at a pub quiz recently. It's quite good when I get questions about gold at pub quizzes because I've usually got a decent chance of getting it right. This one I got wrong because I was asked, when was gold discovered in California? And I said, 1849. I mean, that's what we know, the 49ers. San Francisco even named its NFL team after the 49ers. But no, it turns out that gold was discovered in January 1848 at a place called Sutter's Mill. I think it tells you a lot about how long it takes information to get out, that the gold rush actually only really kicked off big time in 1849. So I got one wrong about gold, which is probably an admission I shouldn't make too frequently.
Kareem, I'm happy to share my fun fact, and then I'll let you close it up if you'd like.
Sure.
Time to get your thoughts together on what you think is interesting. But my fun fact on gold is that there's been a lot of publicity in January of 2024 over the launch of a new ETF category focused on cryptocurrencies, specifically Bitcoin in the U.S. And I just want to remind everybody that it's been 20 years that the U.S. brought the gold-backed ETF to the market in the U.S. But surprisingly, it's not the first gold-backed ETF to come to the market. The first one was in Australia, and the ticker for that is GOLD. That was before the U.S. launched. So in typical fashion, the U.S. capital markets are taking all of the attention, because if you look at Bitcoin ETFs, they already exist in Canada, and they already exist in Europe, and everyone thinks they're new here in the U.S. So 20 years on, we're seeing the same story.
Very interesting. I'm going to go very personal with my fun fact. Now that you spoke about the ETF industry, which is very dear to my heart, and also about gold historical facts, which is history is also dear to my heart. But I'm going to go very personal. My gold fun fact is, so I'm from Lebanon. I was born in Beirut. And in my country, the tradition is that the first gift for newborn babies is gold. And so the first gift that I ever received from every aunt and uncle in my family is a gold coin. And I thought about this when I was preparing for the podcast. And when I go back to visit my family in April, I've already asked my mother that I want to go through them because I haven't looked at them in many years.
That's great. That's really a great one. Thanks very much, Kareem. And for all of our listeners, that's our show for today. Thank you again, Kareem, for joining us. Your insights on the key macroeconomic trends and the year ahead have been very valuable, and on gold as well. So thank you again. And to our listeners, for all of you tuning in, you can keep up with our episodes each month. Be sure to subscribe and follow Unearthed wherever you listen to your podcasts.